Some of you may have heard about the story where the guy was a well-known lecturer, particular fairly complicated subject, and he traveled around a lot of different places giving these this lecture in this fairly technical, complicated material. And he had a driver who drove him to all these places and then sat in the back all the time and listened to everything that was going on. And so as he was driving around, finally one day he said, "You know, I've heard this so many times that I think I could probably give that that lecture myself." And so, you know, he said this a couple of times, and finally, after hearing it several times, the lecturer said, "Okay, why don't we switch places? And let's just have some fun. We'll switch places. I'll put on the chauffeur uniform, and you put on a suit and go up and you give the lecture, and I'll sit back here in the back." So that's what they did. And the chauffeur went up, and he gave the lecture, and the guy who was the real scholar, the lecturer, sat back in the back in the chauffeur's uniform and listened to him. But the problem was that the guy who was the chauffeur hadn't anticipated questions at the end. And so somebody started asking questions, and he was paused for just a moment, and then it came to him, and he said, "Huh, you know, that question is so easy. I'm just going to have my chauffeur answer that for you." So Mike came to me with a question. And that question is just so easy. I'm going to have my good friend Sam take care of that one for me. So Mike was asking about the various temples, and we're going to talk a little more about the rebuilding and the continuation of the Messianic temple. But he was asking about Herod's temple, and where does Herod's temple fit in relationship to this one? And I thought I had a rough idea, but I wasn't sure. And I checked with Sam back there, and Sam confirmed this. Probably during 1st or 2nd century B.C., would be the time during the Roman period and in that time frame where Herod's temple was built and so forth. So just somewhere in there. We'll try to get a little bit more of the idea of this continuation, because he makes a reference here to this temple and to the future glory that's going to come when Messiah is there. So we'll pull that through just a little bit later. Let's look at some of the key people. We're still stuck in Ezra. Not stuck there, but we're there. Let's come back to Ezra. I had already turned over to Haggai. So let's come here to Ezra as we look at the names. And the question that we've been looking at people is this question with Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel and their identities. And let me just go ahead and put all of these up here. Okay. You'll notice in Ezra 1, 8 through 11. So look there for just a moment. Notice in verse 8, Cyrus, king of Persia, bringing forth by the hand of Mithridath, the treasurer, and numbered them unto Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. Verse 11. All the vessels of gold and of silver were 5,400. All these did Sheshbazzar bring up with them of the captivity that were brought up from Babylon unto Jerusalem. Now look over at Ezra 2 and Ezra 2, verse 2. Now these are the children of the province that went up out of the captivity of those which were carried away, whom Nebuchadnezzar the king, which came with Zerubbabel, Jeshua, Nehemiah, and so on and so forth. So in verse 2, it is Zerubbabel who is going up to Jerusalem, taking a group of returning the remnant back to Jerusalem. Notice Ezra 5:14. Let's come over there for a moment. Ezra 5:14, and the end of the verse, they were delivered unto one whose name was Sheshbazzar, whom he had made governor. Now, when we look over in Haggai, in chapter 1 and verse 1 there, very clear reference, it is Zerubbabel. The message is given to Zerubbabel, the governor. Now, Ezra 5:16, once again. Ezra 5 and verse 16. Then came the same Sheshbazzar and laid the foundation of the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. And since that time, even until now, hath it been in building, and yet it is not finished. Now then, if we come over to Zechariah, let's move on back over here. And Zechariah chapter 4. And verse 9. The hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this house. His hands shall also finish it, and thou shalt know that the Lord of hosts hath sent me unto you. Now, and then one more verse over in Ezra chapter 3 and verse 2. Then stood up Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, and his brethren the priest, Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and his brethren, and builded the altar of the God of Israel to offer burnt offerings thereon, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. I remember when they come back, one of the first things they do is build the altar. So what we have here are two men, Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel. And similar statements made about both men. Both men are labeled as governors. Both men are seen as going back with this initial group, going back to Jerusalem. Both are said to have laid the foundation. So, who did it? Is this a contradiction here? Do we have a problem with this? How do we deal with those references? Well, several possible alternatives. Some have suggested that, let me finish these out here. Some have suggested that Sheshbazzar was Zerubbabel's Babylonian name. Possible. And again, some very good people would say they're one and the same person. And it's just different names that are applied. The difficulty I have with that is that the names themselves, for one to be the Babylonian name and one to be his name as a Jew, it just doesn't seem to fit. Zerubbabel means descendant of Babylon. So it doesn't seem to me for that to fit for Sheshbazzar to be his Babylonish name, Zerubbabel to be the name with the Babylon and all of the connections that are there, for that to be a Jewish name. And Sheshbazzar means worshiper of fire. So neither of those seem to carry the idea that I would think you would find in a Jewish name distinguished from a Babylonian name. Both of those would seem to be more Babylonish in nature than Jewish. But, again, that's the way it looks to me. So, you go with that. A lot of good people have. That's their interpretation of it, and that's fine. Some have suggested that Sheshbazzar was the official leader and that Zerubbabel was the popular one. So, however, I have a bigger problem with this than I do with the first one, because both are given official titles as offices. So Zerubbabel is referred to as governor in the same way that Sheshbazzar is referred to as governor. So it's not a matter of official and popular. They both were said to have had the same office. So this is one I really don't see at all. The first one, I think, is a possibility. This is the best one, I think, here, is that Sheshbazzar dies shortly after the return and is succeeded by his nephew, Zerubbabel. Okay. And if you trace out the lineage, you can see all of that. Now, the kinship, your relationship, depends on Sheshbazzar being the same person as Shenazar in 1 Chronicles 3:19. So let's go over to 1 Chronicles 3:19. Okay, 1 Chronicles 3:19, and the sons of Padiah were Zerubbabel and Shimei, and the sons of Zerubbabel, Meshulam and Hananiah, and Shelomith their sister, and Heshubah and Orphal and Berechiah and Hasadiah and Jushabhesed, five. Okay, and we come on down here. Where does this guy come in here? Here we are. And pardon? 18. Did I miss him? Yeah, I just jumped over. It's 18 and 19. Sorry, thank you. Padiah, Shenazar, and Jechamiah, and Hoshama, and Nebabiah. Okay. And nothing, that's wonderful to read through the book of Chronicles, isn't it? Okay. So what you've got here, if Shenazar is the same person as Sheshbazzar, and a lot of people tend to think that that is the case, and just a slight, you find different variations of the names here in the spelling, again, because it's in Hebrew to begin with, so you get differences on that, and a lot of people think that's the same person, this is his nephew, and so one dies, the other takes his place. Another possibility with this is that there were two early expeditions. One is led by Sheshbazzar, who accomplished the start of the foundation, and a second larger one by Zerubbabel. Okay. So either of those are possible, I think. I think the likelihood is that Sheshbazzar does die off of the scene very early on. Now, whether there are two expeditions coming out, one led by Sheshbazzar, the other by Zerubbabel, we don't know. If the first one was by Sheshbazzar, then it was a very small expedition, and a much larger one coming right after that would be with Zerubbabel. Again, we don't know. I think in any case, we don't have anything continuing with Sheshbazzar after any period of time. He is only mentioned in the early segment, only mentioned a couple of times, and everything else focuses around Zerubbabel. So, what is significant for us is that both went to Jerusalem. Both were governors. Both were involved in the rebuilding of the temple. That is, unless you think it's all one person. So, and that's a possibility as well. Okay. Zerubbabel is the dominant figure. And significantly, a direct descendant of David and the last to exercise political authority in Judea until the return of Christ. Okay. So when you come back to his lineage, back over here in 1 Chronicles, you find a direct descendancy going all the way back to David and the last one to occupy any position of authority there. Let's see, it was something else I wanted to mention. Let me see if I do it later on or if I wanted to do it here. No, I guess this is where I wanted to do it. Okay. Oh, okay. Just to connect it with back. Okay. Sorry, I just lost a thought. Just simply the fact he goes back directly to David. And he is in the line, interestingly here, of Jehoiakim, who has the... Oh, okay, I know where I want to talk about. Now, it does come up later. He talks about the signet. ring. And there was a place in there that was referring to this. And he talks about the signet ring and the signet ring being there. And it goes back to Jehoiakim. The Lord makes reference there. So, all right, just one of those things. Hold on to it. We'll get there. Some more of that in his direct lineage. All right. Joshua, another character that becomes important here. Joshua is the high priest. And he's mentioned to us. We've already read him about him here in Ezra chapter 3. Also referred to in Ezra 5, and then also in Nehemiah and in Zechariah, as well as several times in Haggai. The son of Jehozadak, who was deported to Babylon, and we find that in 1 Chronicles chapter 6 and verse 15, it is a direct lineage going back to Aaron. So I think it is significant in these two men that are there, it is a bringing together of both the Aaronic and the Davidic lineage in the post-exilic Judaism. Okay. So with Joshua, the high priest, with Zerubbabel, the governor, you have the person who has the political authority, the person who is the high priest, direct descendant of David, direct descendant of Aaron, and so both of those back that, again, just showing God's directing and God's hand in all of these affairs. And just, again, that his promises are going to be fulfilled and these lines are not lost as a result of being carried off into captivity. That it's all the threads are still there to bring about God's fulfillment of prophecy. Okay. The people. We've been kind of hard on the people. And talked about the sin, the problems, and God's judgment on the people. But and when we look at this, it's a word of exhortation, a call to repentance, but I think there's something also that's important to remember here. And that is, these weren't bad guys. The people that are there, this isn't the bad group. These, from many perspectives, this is a pretty good group of people that are there. You know, this is the remnant that returned. Where are the rest of them? They're in Babylon, getting on with their lives, making money, doing well, prospering. Hey, that's the metropolis, folks. that's major city. That's the good life. Things have changed. This is still not Nebuchadnezzar's day. They're not in captivity. They have assimilated into the Babylonian culture. They are there and they are enjoying life. And now the opportunity, and they come around, Zerubbabel says, hey, who wants to go with me back to Jerusalem? Great opportunity here. They say, are you kidding? Are you gotta be kidding? That's a joke. Well, go back. Why? Tell me about Jerusalem. What's going on there, man? Well, I got a chance. There's not much. Mostly desolation right now, and we can go back. Oh, I'd have to leave my house? What's going to happen to my house? What's going to happen to my kids, my family, my job, my business? I got investments here. You want me to go? You're crazy. Sounds pretty contemporary, but that's what was happening, believe it. Yeah. When we look at this remnant that went back, these are pretty good people. These are people who gave up what was there in Babylon to go back to nothing. Because that's what was in Jerusalem. Nothing. Yeah. They should not be confused with the great wickedness that we've mentioned that was there among the people prior to going into the judgment, going into Babylon and going being taken captive by Assyria, either of those two groups, those captivities. So while we have the judgments coming against Israel at that time and the great wickedness and sin that was there, do not apply that to this group of people. They have their problems. But this group, that's not their main big problem. They separated themselves from their brethren in Babylon to turn to a desolate Jerusalem to rebuild the house of the Lord. They had devotion and zeal for the Lord. And that's what's important to remember with this particular group. And so, and I think they're good applications for us here. You know? Because we're going to see that even in the midst of their zeal and their good intentions, they get distracted. When problems come, they get turned aside. And they're not bad motivations that these people have. They're not doing the wrong things. It's just the important things get lost sight of in the process. And boy, this is something that should speak to our age. I know, as I was going through this, thinking, wow, you know, that really hit right here, today, now, 21st century. They were in Jerusalem, not Babylon. They wanted to be in God's place of blessing. And while there is today no place that we say physically is the place of blessing, in that day there was. And Jerusalem was that place. That was the place where God had chosen to place His name. That was where the temple was. That's where He was to be worshipped. They wanted to do the right thing, which was to rebuild the temple. And when they go back, what's the first thing they do? They start rebuilding the temple. They put in the altar. They're doing this. So they are in the right place, and they're doing the right thing. They gave generously for the work, as we've already indicated, a significant amount of money in addition to their own interest in labors. And then they set about the work itself. So these are people with a lot of positive attributes. And some have suggested also, I didn't put it on here, but that they have the right attitude. They were back wanting to do the work of the Lord. They were in the right place, doing the right thing, and some suggested with the right attitude. They were not doing it just to create a monument for themselves. They were not doing it to say, look what we have done, but they were doing it because they thought it was what God wanted them to do. It was the right thing to do, to go back and to build the temple. Not because it was convenient or anything else, but it was the right thing to do. Okay, and then Haggai himself. His name means my feast or my festival. Some have suggested an indication that he was born on a feast day, others that he was just a joy. You know, we see parents who name their children Joy. I don't know how they knew that from the very beginning. Sometimes I'm sure it may not have worked out exactly that way, but nevertheless, Haggai, my feast, festival, joy. He's the first to prophesy to the returning remnant. And only mentioned twice outside of the book. We have him mentioned in Ezra, in chapter 5, verse 1, and Ezra chapter 6, verse 14, where he simply makes reference to Haggai prophesying. Okay. Nothing is known for sure about his background. There are opposite suggestions about his age, which are drawn from Haggai chapter 2 and verse 3. Let's look there. And, well, you've already got it on your sheets. I can't raise the question with you. Okay. Okay, Haggai 2 and verse 3. Who is left among you that saw this house in her first glory? And how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes in comparison of it as nothing? There are some who think that from that verse that it indicates that he saw the earlier temple, Solomon's temple, before it was destroyed. So therefore, he was alive before, maybe a child in that period, before they were carried into captivity, which would make him a very old man at this point. On the other hand, some look at this and say that it suggests he had not seen the earlier temple of Solomon. So I suggest to you, you make your own judgment. I can't conclude either way from that, whether it says that he had or had not. I don't know. But as I say, some people think that it at least suggests that he may have been an old man at this point, and perhaps Zerubbabel, a younger person, and kind of a Paul and Timothy type of relationship here are in that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He is a contemporary of Zechariah. I got that spelled. Look at that. That's not right. Zechariah. Okay. Can I change that? No. I'm not going to change it now. You know what it is. All right. Ah, good. Got rid of that one quickly. The theme. Fairly succinct. A bit like what we had earlier, prepare to meet thy God. Okay, that's very short, terse, succinct, right here. What's the theme? Rebuild the temple. Get to work. And there's a familiar theme for you right there. Overcome materialism. That's why I say this book is so pertinent to where we are today. Overcome materialism. And secondly, tied in with the same thing, put first things first. Wow. Okay, just get ready to get battered over the head here by Haggai. That's what he did to me. I tell you. He just, you know, I'm reading along, wham, like a 2x4 right between the eyes on this thing. Because there's so many other things that we get to doing. You know, it's not bad things, not wrong things, but not the best thing. And of course, I realize I'm preaching to the choir here, because all of you are here. And you're wanting to be, and you're the ones who are active, and you're the ones who are involved, and you're the ones who are working in your local assembly. But again, there's still easy for all of us to get distracted and get pulled away. And we all get, a lot of different things that you're doing, and I do have a, not a materialistic hobby, but it is a hobby. I enjoy trying to grow some roses. And as any of you know who do that at all, or grow flowers or whatever, it takes time, and you have to keep after it, etc. And I found myself on occasion thinking, wait a minute, this is the day I'm supposed to spray. I got to spray them this week. But there were some other things that needed to be done, and I had to say, wait a minute, God didn't put me on this earth to grow roses. You know, and those roses are going to have to take care of themselves right now. And when I get time, I'll get back to them. There's some other things that are a whole lot more important than doing that. And the ministry that I have at the assembly, and the ministry in the lives of students at school, all of those have got to be top notch. And then after that, somewhere down the line, that's where roses, hang on, I'll get back to you one of these days. But it's very easy to let our hobbies and our other interests and other things that are good, you know, to start getting in a place that this becomes a driving force in our life, and we just start putting off doing other things that we ought to be doing and that should be first. And it's today there are just a whole stack of items that call on our time and demand our time. And that's, in many ways, that's the most important commodity that I have. It's just the time, because it just goes boom, 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 boom. And I was talking to Andy, and it was a minute ago, and we were talking about this and this time frame, and I know he's facing exams right now in school. Some of the other students here are. And I told my wife also before coming to this that if I ever agree to do something like this again in this time frame, just take me in the backyard and shoot me. Let's just get it over with right now. Let's just do it, you know. Just boom, that's it. Because I'm totally worthless. I've lost my mind. And you look at me and say, I must have been totally crazed when I agreed. And I'm looking at a stack of papers at home to grade between now and of essays. And that's essays of graduate students of their papers that have come in, with their essay exams that are going to be coming in the middle of next week, and all that's got to be done. And I'm thinking, you're nuts, absolutely nuts. And that's right. And time. So time becomes one of our most important commodities. of how we manage that time and how we set our priorities. What's here, and what's here? You know, and that's one of my classes, we talk a little bit about that time and time orientation and the time, sometimes the pecking order. You know, in the business world, time is money, and the boss's time is more important than your time down here. Well, in reality, that's not true. Everybody's time is equal because none of us get a fresh supply. You know? When it runs out, that's it. And so everybody, you don't get any more. It's the only thing that you have that you can't get any more of. You know? I don't care how much money you've got or whatever else. Oh, I love this tape. Haggai's distinctiveness lies in his single-mindedness. Single-mindedness. Man, he had an objective. No other prophecy is so fixed on a specific objective, nor is it likely that any other was so successful in its accomplishment. None other so specific, and none other so successful. With his feet firmly planted in the world of the 6th century B.C., Haggai lifted up his eyes and those of his people to the day when the Lord would fill his house with his glory and peace. And this last statement, faithfulness in the comparative little details of today will yield incalculable dividends in the tomorrows to come. Because what we have there, this again is the day of small things. No big deal. No big revival that's going on in this time. It's all small. The temple is small. The rebuilding is small. The people are small. Jerusalem doesn't look good. It's not good at all. But here's what Haggai says. This is a part. It's a part of God's plan. It's a part of the continuation. You're in that line. Boy, what an encouragement. You know? The faithfulness in doing the little thing that fits into the overall scheme of what God is accomplishing in His purpose. Key phrase, consider your ways. Consider your ways occurs 5 times in the book. Okay? Twice in chapter 1, verses 5 and 7, 3 times in chapter 2, verses 15 and 18. So, again, a good exhortation there. Consider your ways. That applies in every age, doesn't it? For us. Take stock. Take stock. Okay, let's look at the overall organization of the book. It's organized around 4 messages from the prophet. Each begins with the date of the message. And we'll say more of this when we get to the specifics over here. And generally, each begins with a phrase, and the word of the Lord came. Now, there's some other times when there's a reference to the word of the Lord coming that doesn't mark a beginning of a different message. It's still incorporated within the same message. The 4 messages are uniquely set apart by the date and by that particular phrase. So both of those are there. There is a problem in chapter 1 that we'll discuss a little bit when we get there and we go through the detailed portion of this. They were preached over a period of 4 months. Again, Haggai dates it very carefully. Rebuilding the temple. Again, I'm just looking at the overall structure of the outline here. And we're going to look at each part of this in just a moment. So I'm just trying to give you a picture of where we're headed. The first chapter 1, verses 1 through 15, looks at the rebuilding of the temple, the exhortation to rebuild, response of God's people. Chapter 2, 1 through 9, is the glory to come, reminder of the past, the presence of the Lord with them, the outlook for the future. The promised blessing in 2, 10 through 19, and their present defilement, present judgment and discipline. Zerubbabel becomes the chosen one, and the divine destruction and divine deliverance. So that's the overall organization of the book. And The organization, there are different ones will give it different ways. This particular organization I followed, I found very helpful in his exposition of this. It was one by Gene Merrill. And it was kind of neat because I'm not sure where he is right now, where he's teaching, but when I was a graduate student at the university, he was there on the Bible faculty and, as I say, since left. And he wrote the book since then, and I didn't really have any connection. I just saw the book, got the book, and then realized who it was. And it was kind of neat because he befriended me in a couple of situations, and during one summer, I got to know him fairly well. And it was kind of neat to go back and find a book that was by him that was especially helpful in the area of Haggai. So it's his outline, essentially, that you see before you. Introduction and setting. Note that the time setting, if you want to look in... verse 1 of chapter 1, the second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month, in the first day of the month, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet unto Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel. Now, notice where the dating is here. Earlier, dating is in terms of the kings of Judah or Israel. Now note, it's in terms of the heathen kings, which certainly indicates a major transition. We are definitely in the times of the Gentiles, Gentile domination, so that everything is dated by them. Now then, we can take this, because of the records that these kings kept and all of their particular calendars and what he says with that, we can put that into very definite dates today. So, by current dating, this would be the 29th of August, 520 B.C. So, that's kind of neat. And calculate it out and put that and say, this when he got that prophecy. It is addressed to Zerubbabel and Joshua. Then let's look at the exhortation to rebuild. And in verses 2 through 6, here, we have the indifference of the people. And note that it is indifference, not wickedness. They're not living in gross immorality and sin. It is just an indifference that is here. I like what the Lord says here. He does not call them my people, but he says this people. And where is that? What verse is that? Somebody see that? Where'd it go? It's right in that first. Pardon? Yes. Okay. This people. Yeah. And the covenant relationship in the past, when God referred to his people, it was always my people. But it is this people. Except the one passage I always get a kind of a kick out of is where the Lord is talking to Moses and says, that group of people that you brought out of Egypt, they sure have messed up a lot. So here, in one sense, the Lord is saying, this people. So he's making a distinction between that and that relationship. Now, their response, they say the time is not come. The time that the Lord's house should be built. A couple of possibilities here. They may have been talking about the right prophetic time. And by that would be a calculation that in terms of Solomon's building of the temple, that was a very specific command of the Lord, and it was very clearly directed of God to build the temple. And David had asked to do that. God had said, no, David, you're not going to do it, but your son Solomon will. And so it was a very clear command there. And so some got back, and because there was trouble, they said, well, it's not, God hasn't specifically commanded this, or else we wouldn't be having all this trouble. And maybe this 70 years here, we miscalculated the time from when the beginning of the 70 years and where we are now, so the right time hasn't passed for the captivity to come to an end. So some were giving a religious reason for stopping the rebuilding of the temple. You know, some of us can do that too, can't we? We find some pretty good reasons for not doing what really we ought to do. And make them sound kind of spiritual at times. And that's what they're doing. I don't think from the tone that Haggai takes and from the rest of the book that that was really, genuinely sincere. May have been with a few, but that wasn't the big problem. And other matters more pressing. Yeah, I think that's where we are in terms of saying what was the right time. Well, just not time. We have some other things we want to accomplish first. And when we get that done, then we'll build the temple. Okay? It's just not a good time for it. The opposition was there, may cause some more difficulties, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's more of an accurate assessment of their view of time. Basically, what I would label as a religious justification for selfish gratification. Okay? A religious justification for selfish gratification. The term for sealed or paneled houses, which is what they were doing, is one and the same, or the same one used for the interior of Solomon's temple over in 1 Kings chapter 6 and verse 9. So, even back this remnant, they were busy building themselves some pretty nice houses. Time to build the Lord's house hasn't come, because I'm adding on to my house. Okay? I'm remodeling here. Okay. You know, boy, get sucked into that. How easy. And it's not, I'm not picking on anybody who's remodeling your house right now. But you know, it can be time-consuming, can't it? You know, that process. And wasn't bad. Nothing wrong with it. And the Lord doesn't here even condemn their doing that. He just says something else ought to be being done as well. Okay? Don't forget this. The house of the Lord needs to be built. Okay? Because the time for the Lord's work had not come, because the time they needed for their own interest was uppermost in their minds. Verse 4, the focus shifts, let's get that here again, shifts from Zerubbabel and Joshua to the people in verse 4, because the message very specifically there in verse 1 is directed to Zerubbabel and to Joshua. Now in verse 4, it goes specifically to the people. Is it time for you to dwell in your sealed houses and this house to lie in waste? Verse 5 is where he issues the first challenge. And here is where he asks them to consider your ways. Literally, set your heart upon your ways. It is for a high degree of reflection and attention. Wow. Set your heart, close examination to your priorities and what you are doing. And is this really what I ought to be doing? Is this the best use of my time and energy? And he says, think about it. Get serious. Four examples of frustration from not putting God first that commence in verse 6. The crops fail. Food is inadequate. The clothing is inadequate. And money loses its value. Now, there had been some crop failures indicated, but I'm not so sure, and it's just an interesting point to think about anyway. When he says here, ye drink, but ye are not filled with drink, ye clothe you, but there is none warm, does that mean they didn't have enough to drink? Or they just had an insatiable appetite? Does that mean they didn't have enough clothes, or they just wanted more? Okay. I'm not so sure that it means that they were poverty-stricken, particularly when you look in the aspect of what they were doing with their homes and what they had given earlier on for the work of the Lord. These seemed to be people who were prospering. And so yes, crops had failed, and they had some problems. The Lord had sent blight and caused difficulties there. But I don't think in every area they were without. I think there was simply, much as we have become a disposable society today, and always a little bit more, a little better, a little bit more of this, I think there was some of that. And I think what he is saying here, you drink, and you never get satisfied, do you? You never have that level of being, this is enough. You know what the Scriptures tell us? Contentment with godliness is great gain. Contentment. And I think that's what he's emphasizing here. You haven't, you can't, you just can't get to that point of being content with what, being content with such things as you have. You know? They always wanted a little bit more. The idea of putting money in bags with holes, some suggest literally that that may have been what was happening. I tend to think that's not what he's talking about. Inflation, perhaps, economy, chips, and what happens? They make more and it's worth less. Okay. Oh boy, that's great, you know. Or stock market could invest in all of this, and all of those people that invested in, let's see, how many people invested in, was it Enron? Any Enron investors here? Okay. You know, riding on cloud nine a few months ago, and now you're walking. Okay, just right through all of that stuff. Pardon, crawling, weeping and crawling. Boy, I'll tell you, all of this, the turnaround that occurred and the high-flying technology stuff and all of that was there and just going and going and gone. What happened with all of that? And it's dribbled out. So that's not inflation. That just lost. So maybe their stock market fell through. I don't know. But we were in a session, I don't know, a couple of years ago. It's one of the in-service sessions at school. And we're meeting with the chief financial officer there, and it was just talking about what the school was doing in terms of retirement benefits and planning for faculty and retirement and all of that, and what they were putting in and so forth. And he said, well, you know, this is what we're doing, and we're trying to be conservative and investing this in the best way possible to be conservative, but to get some return. But bottom line is, we're not trusting in this, and we hope you aren't either. Our trust is in the Lord. And that's our bottom line in all of that. And the Lord's got to provide, and we'll use the best sense the Lord gives to get the best we can for it. But ultimately, the economy and everything else, it says the Lord provides, and He's got to do that. Right perspective. And that's what we need. But here we are. What they're having, nothing but problems coming their way. Okay, this is a good break point. We got 1 minute. We'll stop right there before we start into the instruction to the people.